Payroll tax cut is likely to get extended.
What's it mean for the U.S. economy?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, February 14th.
Coming up, retail sales fall flat for the month of December.
China's next president is visiting, and he's likely to get two very different views of America.
And Valentine's Day, we will cover it from all the angles, from the sweet to the sappy.
It's all ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start with the payroll tax cut that's been putting a little extra money in our pockets for a little more than a year. The tax cut expires at the end of the month, unless Congress decides to extend it. Well, House Republicans, who'd initially said they were looking for spending cuts to offset the tax cut's $100 billion cost, now they say they're going to pass it without offsets.
But they say they're not willing to extend unemployment benefits past this month unless their price tag can be offset. For more on this, we're joined by Mark Zandi. He is chief economist with Moody's Analytics. Good morning.
Good morning.
So it looks like House Republicans have said they're willing to go along with this extension of the payroll tax cut, but only if it's removed from other aspects of the bill, like unemployment benefit extensions. What's going on?
Well, I think Republicans are more suspicious of the unemployment insurance program and the benefit that it provides. There are some disincentive effects. You know, they think that some people are taking advantage of the system. So I think they're trying to separate the two programs, and they're much more favorable about the payroll tax than they are about the emergency UI program.
So do you think this is going to get passed? Will we have it extended through the end of the year?
Yeah, it looks like it. Certainly the payroll tax holiday, I think there's a lot of bipartisan support for that. So, yes, I think that'll happen.
So what does this mean for the economy in terms of growth for the next 10 months and jobs?
Well, I think it's good news. I think we need the payroll tax cut holiday through the end of the year. It's a lot of money. It's almost $100 billion. So that adds up to a few hundred thousand jobs and a couple three-tenths of percent of unemployment. In the context of the economic recovery, which is still fragile, I think this is important. So I think it's good news.
Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody's Analytics. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Two former Bear Stearns executives have settled with the federal government. They were accused of misleading investors about the quality of risky mortgages a few years ago. The two men will have to pay about $1 million, but they won't have to admit any wrongdoing. And as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, that's not good when it comes to deterring future financial crimes.
Like in this case, even when SEC prosecutors extract a fine, they let traders and investors avoid admitting guilt. For the last 35 years, Roman Wheel helped prosecute and defend people accused of trading violations. And he says when the SEC wins,
then all they ask is that the party sign a piece of paper saying, I didn't do it, but I promise not to do it again. That's been the way it's been. It's been quite ineffective.
The SEC is under increasing pressure to have settlements include an admission of responsibility. Columbia Law School professor John Coffey says that's especially true after the subprime mortgage meltdown.
The public isn't satisfied by a defendant saying, maybe I did, maybe I didn't, I'm not saying. That doesn't create any sense of retribution or transparency as to what really happened.
Judges are also criticizing the SEC for settling cases too cheaply. In the Bear Stearns case, the judge called the $1 million penalty chump change. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The government said this morning that retail sales inched up 0.4% last month. That was lower than expected. And it's where we will start now with Julie Niemann, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So what does this morning's retail sales number, up 0.4%, mean for our economy?
Oh, it's just not as much up as hoped. The pattern was still the same, though. The disappointment was in automotive, and that was probably just a temporary low. Fleet sales were down. Dealers are still very promotional. But the rest went really as expected with the retail pattern continuing. High-end did very well. Low-end did well. Your Valentine loot today probably came from either Tiffany's or the dollar store. So middle America, the middle market retailers are still continuing to really struggle in that Sears, JCPenney, Macy's. So Americans really are back at the shopping malls, but they're power walking, not power shopping. dropping, and it's going to stay this way until we see all this huge amount of consumer debt paid down.
And Julie, what about the other big thing? We spend money on gas, and gas prices have risen up to $3.52 a gallon, which I gather is quite high for this time of year.
Well, it is. Oil had been going down due to a mild winter, and typically in winter, nobody's driving much either. So inventories were running pretty lean here. We had a couple of things happen. First, tensions in the Middle East once again, but a lot of the old teapot refineries have been shut down, and we don't have a lot of excess refining capacity out there, and so that little boost there really caused an uptick in prices here. Demand is still very stable. It's not rising significantly. Moreover, consumers have shown that when they see prices going up, they stay home and prices start to ease off then. So the pattern of gasoline is really going to be dependent upon what happens in the Middle East. We've been here before.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Later today, we'll get earnings numbers from online game company Zynga. They make Words with Friends and Farmville. Investors are going to be taking a close look at Zynga's numbers for clues about Facebook. Marketplace's Gregory Warner explains.
From Farmville to Mafia Wars, the only way to do well at a Zynga game is to invite your friends to help you.
And the easiest way to invite your friends, really the only way that makes sense today, is to use Facebook.
That's CNET editor Rafe Needleman.
So Zynga needs Facebook. Meanwhile, Facebook needs Zynga.
Because every time you buy a virtual cow or a virtual cannoli from Zynga, Facebook gets money. Almost $450 million last year. Ray Valdez is an analyst for the tech research company Gartner.
Facebook is the dog. Zynga is the tail. The question is, to what extent does the tail wag the dog?
With so much of Facebook's revenue riding on this one company, he says investors will be scanning Zynga's report today for clues about Facebook's IPO this spring, but watch out.
They're heading in the same direction, but there's also potential collisions there.
Facebook is reaching out to Zynga's rivals, and Zynga is branching out to the iPhone. Neither company wants to remain joined at the hip for good. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. President Obama is meeting today with Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping. Mr. Xi is expected to become China's next president, and this visit may be a final test before he takes over.
For more, we turn to Barbara Hackman Franklin. She was U.S. Secretary of Commerce for George H.W. Bush and has met Mr. Xi. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So what are your impressions of Xi Jinping? What kind of leader will he be?
He was just a young man when his father, who had been a revolutionary hero, was put under house arrest for 16 years. He himself, Xi Jinping, was sent to the countryside, literally living in caves and doing the menial kind of work that happened there. So the point is, he has seen ups and downs in his life. And I think that's going to make him a very interesting kind of leader, because he will have not only the intellectual horsepower, but he will have a common touch because he's been there.
Now, if he does take power in China as expected, how might China's diplomatic relationship with the U.S. change?
Well, you know, this trip really is all about building relationships. If there is a good outcome from this visit, it goes a long way toward building more trust and building the kinds of relationships that will allow U.S. and China to continue to collaborate. We need to collaborate because the globe depends on it.
And what opportunities does a power change in China present to the economy and businesses here in the U.S.?
Well, here again, it's a question of building relationships and building trust. In the meeting that I was in with Xi Jinping, he seemed to understand some of our concerns, like intellectual property protection. Depending on how the relationships are, it really can make a difference in terms of the sorts of progress that we all want to make.
If you were advising Barack Obama on his goal of doubling U.S. exports, what would you tell him about the Chinese market today?
China is obviously a place where we can do better. It's a very important market, but the playing field, we really want the playing field to be level. And that's where the president ought to be heading. And I'm sure that the business leaders that Xi Jinping will meet here are going to make some of these very same points.
Barbara Heckman Franklin, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, while Mr. Xi is in Washington, he's likely to hear about prickly issues like trade disputes and China's undervalued currency. But when he leaves Washington and heads out to places like Iowa and California, he's likely to be having a very different conversation. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
The last Chinese leader to visit Washington was Hu Jintao last year. Members of Congress boycotted the state dinner. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid called him a dictator. Then Hu went to Chicago, where the mayor called him a man of vision. Expect the same extremes during Xi Jinping's visit, says Robert Kapp, former president of the U.S.-China Business Council.
Xi Jinping is going to get a sense of the depth and variety of the country and of the enthusiasm toward China, which is there, along with the fear and the uneasiness.
After Vice President Xi visits D.C., he heads to Iowa and Los Angeles. Both Iowa Governor Terry Branstad and L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa have traveled to China in the past 6 months, and both are looking for more Chinese investment. So, just days after Xi fields concerns from congressmen about China's WTO violations, the mayor of Los Angeles is expected to ask for Chinese investment in California's planned high-speed rail. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Greece today is trying to find another few hundred million dollars worth of budget cuts. It's got less than a day to convince European leaders that it deserves more bailout money.
Meanwhile, the rating agency Moody's has downgraded the credit ratings of 6 European countries, which could make matters worse. The BBC's Steve Evans joins us now from Berlin with more on all this. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Steve, we know there's been a lot of anger in Greece over everything that has to be done to get more bailout money. How are the Germans feeling about all of this?
Well, they don't like it. They see pictures on the television of the German flag being burnt. So ordinary people say, hold on a minute, we're giving them all this money, or we're promising them all this money, and this is the kind of gratitude we're shown. Ordinary people are annoyed about it. Having said all that, the government is very, very sensitive about these things. Obviously, German power, there is historical baggage. So the people, I think, are angry. The people think their generosity is being abused. The government treads very carefully.
And Steve, just as we get close to a big moment like this, along comes the rating agency Moody's, and it downgrades a number of European nations, making things potentially worse.
Yeah, but we've been here before. You've been here before. I think there's much more of a feeling now that the downgrades don't have the catastrophic effect that we once feared, either in the US or in Europe. So clearly politicians don't think it's very helpful, but they don't think it's going to send the train off the tracks either.
The BBC's Steve Evans joining us from Berlin. Steve, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
This winter has been warm here in the U.S., but Europe has been unusually cold. People are staying inside, and the chill is dragging down the economy, already in trouble from that debt crisis. But the freezing temperatures haven't been all bad. The BBC's Rahan Dimitri checked out the Ice Fishing World Championships in Kazakhstan.
A small rocket signals the start of the tournament, and dozens of participants spread out across the lake to begin drilling holes through the ice. They drop bait into the holes they make in the ice and wait. Remember, it's below freezing here, so competitors are equipped with extra special winter gear to keep them warm on the ice bed. Sean Warner from Team USA explains what inspires people like him to sit for hours on a frozen lake.
All fishermen are somewhat addicts, but ice fishermen are real fanatics because they do have to do so much more work under adverse temperatures. We like to call it the extreme sports version of fishing.
Competitor Seth Paponi was having little luck, and when I approached him, he let out some frustrations.
Which country are you from?
I'm ashamed to say from Finland.
Why?
Why? Because of no fish.
The team with the largest catch wins. The U.S. were defending champions, but this year caught just over 4 pounds of fish, giving them a distant ninth-place finish. Belarusia won with 17 pounds. So it looks like, in the ice fishing at least, the Belarusians are winning this cold war. In Kazakhstan, I'm the BBC's Rehan Dimitri for Marketplace.
This Valentine's Day, Jeremy, we'll spend $17.6 billion for chocolates and bears and balloons and jewelry.
Wow.
Guys are going to end up spending about twice as much as ladies. We're going to give 150 million Valentine's Day cards. Do you have any written yet?
I don't actually, but yet. Now that you remind me, maybe I
You
need
have
to.
A mother. She's going to want a card. And the New England Confectionery Company will stamp out 8 billion sweetheart candies with sayings like, be mine and number one fan.
Well, the Westminster Dog Show is going on in New York right now, and we are going to talk about the personal finance of pets.
Today in our Midday Extra, we ask what success at Westminster means to the pet economy. Here to talk with us is author and psychotherapist Stephanie Sarkis. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello. How are you?
Well, thanks. So what would traditional consumer psychology say about how watching the Westminster Dog Show affects people?
Well, you would think that the breed that wins best in show would increase pet sales of that breed, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Even with that really cute beagle a few years ago?
Yeah, the beagle sales didn't increase. And in fact, there's a study that came out in 2004 that found that the dog that wins best in show doesn't increase breed sales for at least 5 years, which is really surprising, kind of goes against consumer psychology.
So what does the dog show do to consumer behavior?
Well, what it does is the commercials and seeing the dogs on TV do remind people that they have to go out and get pet food, or there are ads for pet food, and they might want to try out a new food. So it does increase pet product sales, but it doesn't really change what pet owners spend money on.
Now, does it encourage people to go out and get a dog for the first time?
Actually, that depends more on whether somebody had a dog as a child. That's the biggest determinant of whether someone's going to get a dog. So if they see the Westminster Dog Show, they may enjoy it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to go out and get a dog.
How do you know all this?
There are several studies, actually. The pet industry and pet consumer psychology is a pretty big field. There have been several studies looking at the fact that pet owners, you know, there's certain characteristics that determine how much money you're going to spend on your pet, including how much you attribute human characteristics to your pets. That's one of the factors. So if you attribute human characteristics or anthropomorphism on your pets, you're going to spend more money on them. And also 49.7% of pet owners feel that pets are family members, and that's increased over time.
So with that increase, are people spending more money on their pets? Is the pet economy growing as we think of these dogs as our family members?
Yes, and not only are people spending more money on pet products such as food, leashes, toys, they're also spending money on veterinary bills. So they're seeking out more services for their pets, more health preventative measures for their pets. There's an increase in spending all the way around.
Stephanie, do dogs need those little boot things that people walk them around in sometimes?
I don't know. I live in Florida, so that's not so much a problem for me.
I think it keeps the salt and ice from messing up their paws in cold places like Chicago.
So then it doesn't really make sense why I see them in Los Angeles. But anyway, Stephanie Sarkis is a psychotherapist and author. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, if you don't have the cash for expensive flowers or a fancy dinner for your sweetheart tonight, look no further than the restaurant chain Waffle House. The company is transforming more than 100 restaurants into Valentine Wonderlands. From WABE in Atlanta, Jim Burris reports.
This is Carol. This Valentine's Day, Carol Hamlin is ready to create an ambiance for lovers.
Yeah, we're going to be doing candlelight dinner at the location at Claremont Road and Peachtree Industrial. How many is going to be in your party?
She's busy taking reservations. That's right, reservations at Waffle House. Carol says they're a good idea because there are plenty of takers for Valentine's Day the Waffle House way.
And most of the people that come and do it, they love it because it's a different kind of romance that they get to have.
She says you never know who's going to drop by. Like the wife a few years ago who surprised her husband.
He had on a tux and she had on an evening gown, and they come walking in the door and she unblindfolded him. And he was absolutely ecstatic. So we have all different kind of people.
No formal attire for Sandy Apple and her husband Ron, but they do plan to spend Valentine's here just like they have for the past 4 years.
first time we came, and it was decorated with tablecloths and votive candles on the table. It was kind of nice.
Kelly Thrasher is a Waffle House spokeswoman. She says a district manager got the idea 5 years ago.
So he set up the Valentine's evening at one restaurant, and then from there, we put it out to the whole company, and it just kept growing each year.
113 Waffle Houses from Texas to Pennsylvania now offer the special night. Thrasher says Valentine's Day has become one of the busiest days for participating restaurants.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
So on this Valentine's Day, smatter, smother, and cover your love, and still have a few bucks left in your pocket. And if Waffle House is still too pricey for your taste, the fast food chain White Castle is also dressing itself up this Valentine's Day. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Valentine's Day can be thrilling or mortifying, especially if you're a kid hoping for a Valentine from your crush. It can also be expensive if you're a parent. KJ Dell'Antonia is an author of the New York Times Motherload blog and has been helping her kids get ready for the big day. Good morning, KJ.
Good morning.
So what do classroom Valentine celebrations look like these days?
Well, I think the rule in every classroom right now is one Valentine per kid, no exceptions.
So I've got to give a Valentine to everyone, even my enemy.
Even your archest enemy. I do believe they're allowed to be snarky, but, you know, you'd probably have to create that yourself.
Now, are we talking about paper Valentines, or have phones and technology infiltrated elementary school Valentine's Day parties yet?
You know, I don't think phones and technology have infiltrated. What has infiltrated is candy. We are not talking paper Valentines. We are talking wrapped candy.
And is that going to be a majority of what gets handed out, do you think?
I have a majority. It's probably at least half. The kids really, you know, having sort of seen a Valentine with candy, they immediately appear the next year going, but I want to stick a Hershey, you know, even if you're going to make your own, I want to stick a Hershey kiss on my Valentine. So they like to make it a little present.
Now, what do your kids make of the one Valentine for every kid rule?
It's not that it's occurred to them to question it. It's that two of them are quite small and they're in large preschool classrooms. They get a little tired after about the 9th or 10th, and it becomes a bit of a chore.
Well, happy Valentine's Day to you, and thanks so much.
Happy Valentine's Day, Adrian.
And finally, to one more sappy Valentine's Day story, this one from the UK, where a company that makes those little candy hearts with messages on them has been named the most romantic workplace in Britain. According to the Telegraph newspaper, Adrian, 122 of the company's 500 workers are married to each
other. Wow, that's a lot.
That is a lot, but you need look no further than Southwest Airlines for a similar story. That company boasts 2,416 employees who are married to each other out of a workforce of 37,000. That's pretty good.
They must be going to weddings all the time there, don't you think?
That's right. And they can probably fly for free when they do. And of course, Southwest is based at Love Field in Dallas, Texas, and its stock symbol is LUV.
Very nice, Jeremy. Happy
Indeed.
Valentine's Day.
A little happy Valentine's Day. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.